Being a were-rat was apparently frowned upon in the city. If any Kingsguard happened by right now, he might be murdered or arrested on sight. He had to find somewhere to hide and change back into a dwarf. But even then, he'd be naked, which could also lead to him being murdered or arrested on sight. Come to think of it, maybe these people weren't down on him for being a were-rat after all. Maybe it was the fact that he was currently naked. He looked down and found that, even in hybrid form, his junk was dangling between his legs. His dick was smaller, paler, and more slender than usual, but there was no mistaking it for being anything other than a dick. He put his hands over it and tried to explain himself, but all that came out of his mouth were horrifyingly shrill shrieks. His tongue, teeth, and the shape of his mouth made normal speech impossible.
"How dare you reveal yourself among the decent people of this city!"
cried a man, wielding a normal-looking short sword. This did little to clear the issue as to whether they were upset that Dave was a were-rat, or that he was naked, or which part of a possible combination of the two was the greater offense.
"Get out of here!" cried a half-elven woman. "Go back to the sewers where your kind belongs!"
At least she was more straightforward, though Dave was a little surprised at what seemed like kind of a racist thing to say, especially coming from a hybrid of sorts such as herself. An older human woman thrust her fist down by her side.
"Someone fetch the Kingsguard!"
"No," said the man with the short sword. "There isn't time. It's better to rid the world of this monster while we have the opportunity. Look there, it's already hurt."
The young woman next to him pulled on his sleeve.
"They can't be harmed with normal weapons."
"Nonsense, that's just what they want you to believe."
He pulled his arm free and started advancing towards Dave, slowly at first, then more confidently as others were pressured to join him, lest they look like cowards. Half a dozen men converged on him, armed with swords or daggers, except for one guy who was wielding an iron pipe. Damage reduction wasn't the same as complete immunity. Getting the shit beat out of him by an angry mob with mundane weapons might be an even slower and more painful way to go than being buried alive. Dave decided to take the racist half-elf's advice and seek safety in the sewer. He fled toward one of the exposed sewer tunnels, but hesitated when he came upon a pile of dead bodies. They looked like they'd been butchered to death by some deranged axe murderer. Many of them were missing arms and legs, and while there were also a bunch of severed limbs lying around, they didn't appear to match the human bodies that were missing the limbs. The separated limbs were more slender and covered with fur. Dave wouldn't have known what they belonged to if he didn't currently have a full set of them. Suddenly, the sewer didn't seem like the safe haven for were-rats the woman had suggested it was, but the angry mob was still coming for him, and it was a chance he had to take.
Chapter 33. Stacy's insides were still reeling from the pheasant, but she was confident that she'd further fertilized the fertile desert as much as she was going to for now. It felt good to be in her own clothes again, especially since the robe she'd borrowed from Darton was now torn into scraps, with about a quarter of it soiled and littering the desert floor. It wasn't her fault he didn't have toilet paper available. She was folding the remaining scraps and stuffing them into her pockets for later use when a sharp knock on the door startled her.
"Give me a second," she said. "I'm almost finished."
"Sorry," said Julian. "You know I wouldn't normally bother you in the bathroom. I just wanted to make sure you understood the gravity of the situation. We're in the hotel room of a man who just got arrested. The cops, or constables, or whatever they're called here, could be looking for us right now. This room has to be pretty high up on the list of places they'll search for us."
"I get it. I'll be right out."
"I know you're not feeling great, but we could find another bathroom. If you could just pinch off whatever you've..."
Stacy swung the door open, a little disappointed that it missed Julian, who had wisely decided to badger her in the bathroom from slightly to the side of the doorway. But his face looked so embarrassed and remorseful, not to mention kind of goofy, now that he was back in that ridiculous serape, that she cut him off before he could apologize anymore.
"It's cool. Let's get the hell out of..."
Again, she was startled by a knock on the door. Only this time, it was more than a mere annoyance, as it was the door leading out to the hallway, and it was clearly not Julian doing the knocking this time.
"They're here!" Julian whispered frantically. "What do we do?"
"Shut up for a second. Let me think."
The seeds of an incredibly stupid idea started to take root in Stacy's head.
"Do you have one of those web spells prepared?"
"I have second-level spells available. I could use any of my, yes."
Follow me into the bedroom and take off your serape.
Jesus, Stacy, said Julian. Can you turn it off for a few minutes at least? We're in some serious shit.
Stacy took a deep breath as she dragged Julian by the arm into the bedroom. I understand that, and I'm trying to get us out of it. I need your serape. She spoke in a deliberately patient tone as she realized that she'd kind of walked right into that one. But honestly, how the hell did he imagine the web spell was supposed to have factored into whatever pre-arrest quickie she'd supposedly had in mind?
Okay, sorry, said Julian, taking off his serape. I'm just kind of freaked out right now, and I'm glad to hear you've got a plan.
Stacy pulled the duvet off the bed and tossed it aside. You might not be so glad when you find out what it is.
What is it?
I'll tell you later. Right now, I need you to stall whoever's at the door. I'll use your diplomacy skill, but maybe try to barricade the door with furniture if you can do so without sounding like you're doing so. I'm going to need a little time.
Right.
Julian ran out of the room.
Just a minute. I'll be right there.
Stacy removed the thin sheets from the bed. Lightweight, durable, and very large. Just what she needed. With the dagger she kept concealed in her boot, she cut the fabric into the shape she needed, then took them outside to the back balcony and started sawing away at the long bamboo stalks in the garden.
I'm just lacing up my pantaloons,
said Julian as he tiptoed to the door carrying a single chair. Stacy considered stripping the leaves off the bamboo stalks to minimize drag and maximize gliding distance, but the leaves might provide more surface area for the web to cling to, thereby maximizing the odds of this thing working at all and minimizing the chance of a sooner and more abrupt death. Also factoring into her decision was the time it would take to strip off the leaves. There was only so long Julian could keep up the getting dressed shtick, and depending on the severity of the crimes Darton was allegedly mixed up in, there were only so many fucks the authorities were going to give about whether the alleged accomplices they were hunting down were dressed or not. After throwing handfuls of loose dirt all over the patio bricks until she was satisfied, Stacy spread Julian's serape flat on the dirt.
What are you doing? Asked Julian, taking a curious peek at her handiwork. I just had that cleaned.
Whoever was at the door knocked again, this time louder and more rapidly.
Keep stalling, said Stacy.
Julian went back inside.
I'm coming! You just caught me at the worst possible time. I was in the bath, you see.
Stacy laid the two large sections of bedsheet fabric perpendicular to Julian's serape to form an almost unrecognizably thick T-shape, or perhaps a snow angel was a more appropriate description. Then she laid the bamboo framework down along the edges of the white bedsheet wings. It wasn't a masterpiece, but it would have to do.
Julian,
she said as she lay between the wings, spreading her arms out and gripping the bamboo stalks framing the bottom of them, her legs lying along either side of the serape. Julian appeared in the patio archway.
What is this? What are you doing?
I don't want you to take this the wrong way, said Stacy, but I need you to lie on your back so that I can lay my head in your crotch.
What?
Hurry up. Think of it like you're sitting on my shoulders, except we're lying down.
Why are we doing this?
Stacy sighed.
Oh, is it not completely obvious?
No, said Julian. It's not in the least bit obvious.
Still, he followed her instructions and lay on his back, scooting toward her until she could lower her head between his legs. Stacy grabbed Julian's ankles and repositioned them so that they were crossed over her chest. Now stretch your arms out as far as you can to your sides and grab hold of those bamboo stalks.
Okay, said Julian, grabbing the stalks along what would soon be the front of the wings. Now what?
Now cast your web spell, silly.
On what?
On us, said Stacy. On this whole thing.
Maybe if I had a better idea of what we were trying to accomplish, I could...
A small clatter of wood caused Stacy to jerk her head up. The room door was open a crack, blocked for now by Julian's meager efforts to barricade it, but that wouldn't last long.
Now,
said Stacy, bringing her head back down quickly.
Ooh!
Stacy realized she may have come down a bit hard on Julian's testicles.
Sorry, now please cast the spell.
Julian shifted his legs and ass around a bit, then said,
Web!
The light dimmed as Stacy's vision filled with white sticky strands of magical adhesive. Fortunately, she could still make out basic shapes well enough to do what she needed to do.
Keep your legs tied around me, she said.
Julian's thighs squeezed on her head.
Did I do it right?
He asked.
I mean, with the web, is this the effect you had in mind?
We'll soon see. Remember to keep your arms spread wide.
Stacy sat up slowly, partly due to the weight of Julian on her shoulders, but mostly to make sure her contraption stayed together. The loose dirt helped the web peel easily away from the brick patio floor, just as she hoped it would. Standing up proved tricky with both of her legs glued to the serape, but her high strength and dexterity scores came through for her.
"Be careful," said Julian nervously. "I can't see very well, and we're close to the edge of the... Stacy, what the hell are you doing? Are you crazy?"
Stacy waddled to the edge, squatted, then jumped onto the railing.
"No, I'm awesome!" She leaned forward.
"Fuck, fuck, 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 fuck!"
cried Julian as Stacy's head threatened to burst like a watermelon between his legs. Stacy felt a rush of sensations all at once. There was the head squeezing, of course. The sudden rush of warm desert wind rushing up due to their free fall. The sudden rush of warmth on the back of her neck from,
"Are you peeing on me?"
she shouted.
"I'm sorry!"
Stacy realized that the wind was still rushing straight upward, meaning that they hadn't yet leveled out. She also became aware that her arms were being jerked up and down.
"Stop flapping! This is a glider!"
She would have liked to be controlling the front of the wings, but she needed her leg strength to work the tail. Spreading and straightening her legs, Stacy pointed her toes toward the sky, then brought her arms down slightly to dip the backs of the wings.
"Pull your tips up!" she instructed Julian.
"Fuller tit sauce?"
"Tips! Wing tips! Pull them up!"
Stacy felt a wobble of almost quasi-stability as Julian followed her orders. It was a tiny wobble, just enough to suggest that there was probably a right way to do this. The fact that they were still in free fall suggested they hadn't yet discovered it.
"Too high! Bring them back down a little!"
After another wobble, they were falling slower. The wind was still rushing straight up and fast enough that they still probably wouldn't survive hitting the ground at this speed, but it was definitely an improvement. Stacy tried a number of minute adjustments to the parts of the glider under her control, raising and lowering her arms, pulling up her knees, and putting her legs out straight again. While several attempts seemed to worsen their situation, few did them any good. Not wanting to die without having tried everything she could think of, she tried lowering only her right arm. Something changed, and they finally harnessed some significant air. They were moving forward, kind of. It was more like a wide downward spiral, but it was a hell of a lot better than straight down.
"It's working!"
cried Julian.
"Stacy, you're a genius!"
That was sweet of him to say. She didn't have the heart to tell them they were still going to die if they hit the ground at this speed.
"Of course!"
Julian shouted over the wind.
"We're still going to die if we hit the ground at this speed!"
Stacy moved her head left and right, trying to clear some of the web out of her face. Her vision became clear enough to see that they had a lot less time than she thought to find the exact wing tilts they needed.
"Julian, we're getting close! You need to try some adjustments. Nothing too big. Tiny movements and see what works."
"I've got a better idea!"
"Don't summon a horse. Don't summon a horse. Don't summon a horse."
"Celestial Giant Bee!"
Stacy had to admit, that was unexpected. A massive gold and platinum striped honeybee, about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, appeared just below them, its rapidly flapping wings, two silvery blurs, flanking its metallic-looking furry body. It took in its surroundings curiously with eyes that looked like giant mirrored sunglasses. Stacy wanted to ask Julian how the bee was supposed to help them, but the hum of its wings was deafening. That made sense, considering how loud a normal bee's buzz could be from the speed it needed to flap to stay airborne. As big as this thing was, it had to be flapping like a mofo. One more spiral would have them slamming right into the bee. She could understand how it might be helpful to have a flying creature of that size shoulder some of their weight and slow their descent, but surely Julian must have been taking into account that...
"Shit!"
said Julian, as the buzzing abruptly stopped and Stacy found herself with a face full of prickly bee hair.
"Sorry, that was poorly thought out."
Stacy corrected her train of thought. Apparently Julian hadn't taken into account that the bee's wings would likely get stuck in the web, as that was the exact purpose for which webs had evolved. The glider went from a spiral to a spin. With the giant bee ass in her face, it was now impossible to tell how fast they were falling. Stacy stretched her legs as wide as the serape and web would allow and adjusted her arms to try and get that spiral back, but she couldn't see anything.
"Julian, I can't see! You need to bring us down!"
"Celestial Giant Bee!"
said Julian.
"What the fuck?"
Stacy felt another sudden jolt. no doubt meaning they'd smacked into another giant magical bee. Once that guy gets a solution in his head, he sticks with it, no matter what the...
Splish!
She couldn't see. She couldn't breathe. She could barely move. The only evidence she had that she was still alive was all the pain. It was like someone had thrown a wall at her. No time for pain now. Breathing was the top priority. With a little bit of effort, she pulled her arms free from the bamboo and scraped the web out of her face, along with whatever foul-tasting liquid was mixed in with it. Once she cleared it from her nose and mouth, rendering her able to breathe again, she cleared it out of her eyes. It was bee guts. She was writhing in the abdomen of a giant squashed bee. Julian must have summoned that second one, figuring that using giant bees to break their fall was better than... Julian! Stacy sprang to her feet. Julian lay face down inside the crushed abdomen of the other bee. She grabbed him by the shoulders and flipped him over, then wiped the bee guts off his face and checked his pulse. She sighed with relief when she found it. He was alive.
Julian! He groaned as he opened his eyes.
Are we? Did we?
His eyes widened as he looked up at the sky.
Holy shit! We did it! We're alive!
Stacy looked up. The crescent shadow was high above them, and then, in the blink of an eye, it was gone.
Yeah, we did it all right, she said. Of course, now we're stranded in the desert.
Chapter 34. Those passengers of the Maiden's Voyage who had survived the fight with fewer limbs than they'd started the trip with were understandably upset about it. Randy felt bad leaving people in pain, but he limited his lay-of-hands ability to one hit point per injured passenger, just enough to stop the bleeding and stabilize the recipient. Once that ran out, he helped administer more conventional methods of treatment, such as tourniquets and cauterizing irons, under the supervision of one of the ship's crewmen who had evidently taken some ranks in the heal skill. They screamed, cried, cursed the gods and Randy, some of them pleading with him just to let them die. But the crewmen who had sustained identical injuries were shockingly laid back about it. It came as no surprise to Randy, of course, that sailors would generally be a hardier breed than most. It's a hard life at sea, but how tough did a person have to be to act so casual at the loss of a limb? This was a life-changing event. No matter what rough experiences they'd had in the past, they'd gotten through them with all their limbs until now. They were going to face some serious limitations, or at least have to work really hard to overcome them, and yet they laughed and compared the sizes of their bloody stumps. Randy even heard one guy complain that he'd lost a tattoo he really liked. Was there some kind of nautical peer pressure to act manly no matter what tragedies befell them? Was it the denial stage of grief? Were they simply really that tough? Nightwind's crew, who had performed more effectively during the battle, at least had the presence of mind to be upset about the limbs they'd lost. One patient Randy hadn't tended to was Denise. Now that he thought about it, he couldn't recall seeing her during the fight or at all since the previous evening. He hoped she hadn't been thrown overboard in battle. Glancing over the railing revealed nothing but the choppy waves. Whatever the sea was hiding under them, she wasn't telling. Denise might have crossed over to the Nightwind to help Catherine get established, but Randy wanted to check their cabin first, just to rule it out.
No!
Cried Denise from inside as Randy approached the door.
Stop it! Get off me! That hurts!
Denise! Randy braced himself against the railing and kicked in the door. Denise was naked on the floor, punching and kicking at their assigned cabin mate. He was also naked, grunting and sweating, meeting Denise's paltry attempts to defend herself with heavy-handed slaps as he tried to force himself on her. Randy grabbed Denise's assailant by his greasy ponytail and pulled back hard.
You son of a bitch! I'll kill you!
The rapist shouted in pain as his head jerked back. He hopped to his feet and swung his elbow back, catching Randy in his left cheekbone. It smarted, but Randy kept his grip on the big guy's hair. Randy hadn't realized how big this guy was, and an admirable collection of scars adorned his naked flesh, suggesting that he had more fighting experience as well. But Randy knew no fear, for he had something even better, the smiting power of Jesus.
Randy! Said Denise. God damn it!
Randy was ready for the elbow when it flew back at his face again. Ducking under it, he thrust his free hand to his adversary's junk and gripped his balls as tightly as he could.
By the power of Jesus Christ, I smite you!
He shuddered as he felt the big man's testicles squish like grapes in his hand.
Oh!
Said the rapist. No time to get squeamish. Randy let him out through the doorway and flipped him over the rail. He hit the water hard and cradled his crushed nuts.
Hagarf!
Denise stood naked in the doorway, her fists clenched and shaking with anger, but she kept her voice down like she was worried someone might hear her.
Are you out of your goddamn mind, Randy?
What? Said Randy.
What the fuck was that all about? Could you not see that I was in the middle of something?
What? Randy repeated. He had neither expected nor wanted a display of gratitude during what would presumably be a very traumatic time for Denise, but he certainly wasn't expecting this.
It looked to me like you was in the middle of getting raped.
I was,
shouted Denise, peeking over the railing. Then she leaned back and spoke in a quieter voice again.
At least that's what he thought.
What?
Randy would have liked to vary his responses, but Denise just wasn't making any sense.
Thank you, mighty paladin,
Denise was shouting again.
You saved me from that despicable evil man. I'm eternally grateful.
She shoved Randy and whispered,
hurry up and throw him a goddamn rope or something, and you'd better be able to set his balls right again.
Randy stood confused for a moment, his moral compass spinning wildly. He'd felt both justified and righteous by causing harm to his friend's assailant. The big man's intentions were evil, but he'd been tricked into acting on them. Randy supposed that in times of doubt, he would do best to err on the side of forgiveness. Randy found a coil of rope on the deck and tied in a wide loop at the end. He guessed it was put there for just this situation. Well, the man-overboard situation, anyway. Not necessarily the I purposely squeezed a man's balls to jelly and threw him overboard situation. That was way too specific an event to prepare for, after all.
Praise the gods,
cried Denise, looking over the rail.
That vile man is drowning!
She backed away from the rail and glared at Randy.
Hurry the fuck up, would you?
All right,
fine. Randy had half a mind to throw her in after him. He tossed the loop of rope down to Hagarf, but found Denise was right. He did appear to be drowning. His head was dipping below the waves, and he wasn't going for the rope.
Oh, man.
What?
Said Denise. She came back to the rail and gasped.
What the hell you waiting for, Randy? A fucking invitation? Get in there and save him!
Randy climbed over the rail and jumped into the water. It was colder than he expected, and his boots made swimming difficult. In retrospect, it probably would have been wiser to take them off first. Fortunately, he was close enough to grab hold of the rope in one hand and Hagarf's ponytail in the other. He pulled the big man up until his head was above the water, then looped the rope under his arms. Randy was about to shout for Denise to pull up the rope, but he noticed that Hagarf was completely unresponsive, and his face was a little bluer than what seemed healthy. He must have taken water into his lungs. Fearing he might not survive the time it would take to be pulled back on board the ship, Randy decided to administer some amateur CPR there and then. He kept his left hand firmly gripped on the rope to avoid sinking under the waves himself, and used his right hand to pinch Hagarf's nose. He pressed his lips to Hagarf's and tried both blowing and sucking, not sure which, if any, was the appropriate method.
Hey!
Shouted Denise.
The fuck you think you're doing? You people ain't got an ounce of self-control!
Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation didn't seem to be doing anything, so Randy tried the only other move he could think of. He was pretty sure the Heimlich maneuver was more for people who had a chunk of hot dog wiener blocking their lungs than for drowning victims, and he'd never been trained on how to do it properly, but it wasn't like screwing it up was going to make Hagarf any more dead than if he did nothing at all. Randy turned Hagarf around and hugged him tight from behind, gripping his greasy ponytail with his teeth to keep his face out of the water. Hoping that he was at least kind of doing it right, he tightened and loosened his arms around Hagarf's abdomen, then repeated the process.
Jesus titty fucking Christ, Randy!
Denise shouted down at him.
Ain't you got no shame at all? That's fucking disgusting! And you got the nerve to prance around calling yourself a follower of...
Finally, Hagarf vomited out what seemed like several gallons of seawater, then started coughing violently. He no doubt felt like complete shit, but he was going to be okay. Although he was responsible for nearly ending Haggarth's life, Randy felt proud of himself for saving it.
"He's all better now," Randy called up to Denise. "Pull him up, then throw the rope back down for me."
"What the hell'd you do to him?"
"He was drowning. I gave him the Heimlich maneuver to force the water out of his lungs."
Oh, man, I had that all wrong. From up here, it looked like you was butt-fucking him."
"Hey, man," said Randy, "it's kind of cold in here. Would you mind hurrying this up a little?"
Denise nodded.
"I'm really angry."
Haggarth's coughing started to subside. He turned his head back to look at Randy.
You crushed my testicles."
"Sorry about that," said Randy. "I was just looking out for my friend is all."
He nodded up to Denise, who had just transformed into an extremely niche porn category. Her breasts were like water balloons poking out from huge pectoral muscles. Her legs were like the Incredible Hulk's if he were a lot shorter and played a lot more tennis. Her hoo-ha looked like it could crush a grown man's arm if he could manage to get it through that dark forest of Brillo. Haggarth looked up as he got lifted out of the water.
"What is that? No! Someone help me!"
Without Haggarth and the rope there to hold on to, Randy found himself having more trouble treading water than he felt he should, even taking his boots into account.
"What? What's going on?"
he said, ineffectively slapping at the water.
Why can't I swim?"
It didn't make any sense. He'd always known how to swim ever since he was a kid. It had been a few years since he'd last done it, but that wasn't the sort of thing one loses completely due to lack of practice. It wasn't like he was trying to compete in the Olympics. He was only treading water.
"Denise!"
he shouted, stretching his neck to avoid submerging completely. His cry for help came out mostly as bubbles. Kicking his boots off quickly as he could, he thought it odd how calm and rational he was being, and how unafraid he was of what he imagined was a horrible way to die. His boots off, he pointed his feet downward and kicked his legs forward and back while cupping his hands and trying to push himself up through the water. The effort was enough to break the surface, but not by much. Reasoning that Denise was well aware that he was down there, it seemed wiser to suck in as much air as his lungs could hold than to expel air calling for help again. Randy continued to kick and flap his arms, but though his efforts might have been slowing his descent, they weren't stopping it. He was underwater and sinking deeper. He looked around, hoping he might see a pretty fish before he died. Then he considered that, since he was in a fantasy world, he might be shortchanging himself by hoping for a fish, no matter how pretty it was. What if there were mermaids out here? Wouldn't that be something to see? But he saw neither fish nor mermaid, just an endless expanse of blue-green water and the barnacle-dotted hull of the maiden's voyage. Glancing upward to have one last look at the surface, he spotted some strange movement. The waves were jostling the surface too much to make out a clear picture, but it almost looked as though a person was... No, that couldn't be. Catherine's face broke through the surface, her blonde hair fanning out in the water like a halo. She wasn't swimming, but rather crawling along the side of the ship's hull.
"Catherine!"
Randy tried to say, but it came out in a cluster of bubbles. Catherine reached out to him, saying something in response that might have been, "Take my hand, you dumb fucking redneck," or it might have been something nicer. Randy was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. He gave one last flap of his arms, then stretched his left arm toward Catherine's, just managing to hook his fingertips on hers. She flattened herself against the hull as she pulled in her fingertips, then let go suddenly and made a grab for Randy's wrist. Once she had a firm grip, she pulled him toward her slowly and carefully, as if her strange ability to cling to the hull was compromised by his weight pulling her away from it. Placing his hand on the waistband of her jeans, she gave him a warning glare, which either meant that he shouldn't try anything funny or that he shouldn't think that she was trying anything funny. Randy guessed that Catherine was better able to crawl with both hands free, and she was providing something other than her hand for him to hold on to. He nodded and dug his fingers in between her jeans and her left butt cheek. Now that he was in there, it felt inappropriate enough so that he could understand her having given him that look. Once Randy's grip was secure, Catherine started crawling slowly to the surface. Randy was getting close to his breaking point as far as his breath was concerned. His lungs wanted filling, and he wasn't going to be able to keep from sucking in for very much longer. Come on, Randy. Don't give up now. You're almost there. Catherine stopped climbing when she broke the surface. She reached down and grabbed Randy by his right armpit to pull him up level with her. Randy sucked in as much salty sea air as his lungs would hold.
Do you really not know how to swim? Said Catherine.
I was always a good swimmer.
You call that swimming? You look like you were trying to fight off a swarm of angry bees.
I don't know what happened. I just choked, I guess.
It's probably a game thing, said Catherine. Doesn't matter now. Listen, I'm not going to be able to support your weight out of the water, so we're going to need to... Shit!
Randy assumed that last word was not how she'd intended to finish that sentence. She was no longer clinging to the boat, and Randy was starting to sink again, now unable even to perform the poor excuse for swimming that he'd been doing before now that his hand was stuck in Catherine's pants. Knowing he was about to go under again, he took a deep breath. He sank like a rock, dragging Catherine down with him until she finally wrenched his hand free of her pants. It was nice of her to try to save him. He offered her a friendly smile and a wave as he descended. He'd lived as good a life as he knew how. Ever since he'd been in this world, he'd done some good things and made some nice friends. He was at peace with himself and ready to accept his fate. Catherine, however, wasn't ready to accept his fate. She swam down toward him, pulled out her bag of holding, and gestured for Randy to get in. As soon as she brought the bag within his reach, Randy helped Catherine pull the mouth over his head and squeezed his body through. It was dark inside, which was probably for the best, considering all the dead dire rats that were bound to be floating around in there with him. He floated in empty space, not frightened, but aware that any moment one of those rat corpses might brush against him. Instead, he was hit repeatedly by floating globs of salt water. In the void, he thought about what the odds were of Catherine finding him at just the right time. To the best of his knowledge, she had already crossed over to her new ship. Had she been given some kind of sign? He was hesitant to even entertain the thought, but was it possible that Jesus might have tipped her off? His train of thought was derailed by Catherine's firm grasp on his wrist again. The next thing he knew, he'd been ejected from the bag of holding and spilled onto the maiden voyage's rear deck.
"Are you okay?" asked Catherine.
Randy nodded.
"How did you find me?"
Catherine accepted a blanket from one of Captain Longfellow's crewmen and wrapped it around herself.
"With no help from your buddy Denise, that's for sure."
She shivered, which might have been due to a breezy chill after having just gotten out of the water, or might have been due to whatever she'd seen that was making her bring up Denise.
"I was looking for you two to see if you wanted to ride on my new ship."
"That was thoughtful of you. It's lucky you happened by just in time for Denise to tell you where I was."
Catherine scoffed.
"Oh, Denise didn't tell me shit. She was all hulked out and naked, manhandling our bunkmate into the cabin. He looked terrified. I think he might have been crying."
Randy frowned.
"If Denise didn't tell you, then how?"
"I happened to glance over the railing, and I saw your hand going underwater."
She took off her blanket and wrapped it around Randy.
"Are you saying that Denise knew you were in the water? Did she throw you in there?"
"Of course not," said Randy. "We're friends. She'd never do that. Her mind ain't quite right when she's in that barbarian rage. She was probably just distracted is all."
He thought up another question quick to change the subject.
"How is that you were crawling around on the side of the ship like that?"
"That was a spell. It timed out just after we surfaced. I'll have to keep better track of the spell duration next time. And you need to learn how to swim next time you level up."
Randy nodded.
"I suppose that ain't a bad idea. So are we set to part ways with Captain Longfellow now that you got your own boat?"
"Not quite," said Catherine. "He's requested that we make one stop together first."
Chapter 35. Nabi felt restless in Cooper's hands. He hoped it didn't have anything to do with her sister suggesting that he was trying to bone her.
"It's not that at all. Hollywhirl can be a touch overprotective."
Cooper didn't have a lot of thoughts that he didn't blurt out as soon as he had them, but he was uncomfortable with his mind being completely naked for Nabi to read. There weren't many better ways he knew to avoid thinking than idle chatter, so he continued the conversation.
"And what's wrong?"
said Cooper. Chaz and the satyr glanced his way, saw he was talking to the axe, then continued their perpetual paranoid scans for shadows in the forest. Cooper nearly fell backwards off the sled when Hollywhirl appeared in front of him, flying backwards at the pace the boar was running.
Does something ail my sister?
I thirst for the souls of the wicked, and I've not seen one of those damned dark ones all day.
She's thirsty,
Cooper said to Hollywhirl. Then he addressed the axe again.
I hear you. I could really use a beer, and I haven't seen a bar in this forest either.
Hollywhirl seemed satisfied with the dullness of their conversation as she flew ahead and vanished.
There will be time enough to dull your wits when I'm free of my prison, and the Dark Lord and all his minions have been destroyed.
There'll be time enough for you to eat my ass.
I can hear you.
Shit. So,
said Cooper, looking around for any stimulus for further meaningless conversation.
What's your favorite kind of tree?
Oak.
Oh.
He looked around for another stimulus, but the forest had blown its suggestion load with that first one. Instead of another question to ask, all he got from the effort he was putting into thinking was gas. It came out long and loud and briefly gave him the sensation of riding a motorcycle.
The Dark Ones appear to be more timid today, said Zanzafuck,
or whatever the satyr's name was.
Can you really think of no better use of our time than to ask your axe what its favorite tree is?
We're being dragged through the forest by pigs. What the fuck do you want us to do, Mr. Productivity? Take up knitting?
I just thought we might discuss possible reasons why the Dark Ones are more timid today. Of course, it seems like a good thing, and not having to stop and fight one every 5 minutes is getting us to our destination quicker. But knowing the reason why might provide us with valuable information on how we might better keep from becoming one of them.
I have a theory about that,
said Jazz.
We're traveling deeper into the forest right now, aren't we?
The satyr nodded.
They're clearing everything out from the point of origin onward. Once every bird, bug, and chipmunk have had their life force sucked out of them, and these Dark Ones have nothing left to consume. Their only option is to spread outward. They prefer to stay in the forest for its cover of natural shadows for now, but it's only a matter of time before their thirst will push them beyond their comfort zones.
That's a good thing, right? Said the satyr. Being able to see them makes them relatively easy to destroy.
That's true for anyone who comes across them and knows what they are, how to kill them, and happens to have magical weapons on them. Anyone else is likely to run away or be turned into one of them.
The goat man frowned.
That's less good.
Without significant opposition, they'll continue to spread until they reach new forests where they can start the process all over again.
Glitter Sprinkles Grove is small and isolated. Most of the other forests around here are much bigger and interconnected. If the Dark Ones reach another forest, they might easily take over the whole continent.
We can use their desperation against them.
We can use their desperation against them,
said Cooper. Chaz and the goat man looked at him doubtfully.
It was Nabi's idea.
Their eyes lit up with sudden interest.
Oh?
Said the goat man.
Well, let's hear it,
said Chaz.
First of all, fuck both of you.
Cooper prepared himself for the mentally exhausting task of relaying Nabi's telepathic communication aloud. As he listened, Nabi seemed to be getting a better grasp of how much information he could relay in a single chunk.
Construct more light wards, a moving wall of light, force them into tight pockets of shadows along the edge of the forest, then move in, flush them out into the ward's light or the sunlit meadows beyond the wood, and destroy them.
The goat man stroked his billy goat beard thoughtfully.
The idea is not without merit.
We are too few in number to carry it out,
said Hollywhirl.
It would sate one's axe lust to cleave the souls of Dark Ones, but we'd never make our way around the entire grove before they are desperate enough to go beyond the edge.
It's better than sitting around inside a stationary perimeter of light wards and hoping everything will sort itself out,
said Cooper. He pointed to the axe.
Her words.
One strategy that is doomed to fail is just as good as another strategy that is doomed to fail.
Hollywhirl became visible and held up a finger, warning Cooper not to argue with her anymore.
We're nearly at the Pool of True Sight. I will continue bickering with my sister once I've confirmed it's her.
That was just fine with Cooper. From the absence of unsolicited thoughts in his head, it was just fine with Nabi as well. A few minutes later, the boar slowed to a stop next to a group of four trees. That alone wouldn't have been noteworthy, considering they were in a forest, but these four trees were distinguishable by virtue of being fat, ancient-looking oaks with branches that sloped all the way down to the ground. And while the other trees were dispersed randomly throughout the forest, these four oaks stood as corners of a perfect square. Their roots mingled and twisted around each other, forming the sides of the square and trapping a pool of stagnant black water inside them. The branches likewise mingled together as if they were all part of the same super tree. Now that he thought about it, this seemed like something he should have noticed from further away. He hadn't been staying hyper-aware of his surroundings, but this was kind of an unusual thing to jump out at him like that.
"Is this the place?"
said Cooper.
"Or are we just taking a pee break? I kinda need to take a dump."
A conclusive response wasn't really necessary. As long as they were stopped, he would take his dump. He walked over to the nearest low-hanging branch and grabbed a hold of it at the height which best facilitated his ability to squat. He was a little uncomfortable with the knowledge that so many invisible people were hovering around, any of whom might be watching him take a shit. He had to remind himself that he wasn't a young Asian woman on the internet, so the likelihood of anyone wanting to watch him defecate was remote at best.
"You are a stranger to my wood," said a nearby scrawny tree, which had just turned into an elf.
He wore a simple wool cloak the same shade of gray as the bark of the tree he'd just been. He stared at Cooper expectantly with his bright green eyes.
"I'd like to keep it that way,"
said Cooper.
"I'm kind of in the middle of something. Could you maybe go away or at least turn around?"
"I demand to know what business you and your traveling companions have here."
"Dude, if you could just give me a little bit of privacy, I can do my business, and you can study it as hard as you like."
"Barnabas,"
said Hollywhirl, becoming visible between Cooper and the elf, who was intensely watching him try to take a dump.
"These people are with us."
"Jesus Christ, guys. Would it kill you to take this conversation like 50 feet over that way?"
"This is Barnabas. He's the guardian of the Pool of True Sight. I feared the Dark Ones might have taken him. I am much relieved to see that he appears to be unharmed."
Cooper had gotten used to shitting in Nabi's presence, but now that she was suddenly reminding him that she was part of a larger audience, he wished that she would step away as well.
"We seek vision from the Pool of True Sight,"
said Hollywhirl.
"The half-orc claims that his axe houses the spirit of my sister Nabi."
Barnabas folded his hands and bowed to Hollywhirl, then to Cooper.
"You are welcome to use the Pool of True Sight, but be warned that the Dark Lord's influence has corrupted it. As he draws power from the roots of the sacred trees, the pool's ability to show truth is compromised."
Hollywhirl turned to Cooper.
"We must take your axe."
"I wish you would."
Cooper felt the axe being unstrapped and lifted from his back. Then he saw it float toward the black pool between the four fat oak trees, accompanied by Hollywhirl and Barnabas. Realizing he might not get any more privacy than he had right now, he concentrated on emptying his bowels, but was still unable to get his mind and body to comply. In the back of his mind, he knew that while the pixies had bigger fish to fry than watching him take a shit, they were also into some freaky shit. He wouldn't put it past that one who wanted to jerk Chaz off to be hanging back to pleasure herself to the sight of him soil the soil. When the axe was lowered into the pool, a holographic image appeared above it, which opened Cooper's sphincter muscle like the valve on a pressure washer. He lost about 10 pounds in 2 seconds. The figure was pixie-like, but wingless. That much was accounted for by Nabi's claims, but the image, while familiar, was a far cry from the image of Nabi that Cooper had once seen in his dreams. Her skin was wrinkled, not so much like an old woman, but more like a younger woman who lived an extremely hard life. Her eyes were sunken, and deep creases in her face highlighted sagging jowls. It seemed like every vein in her body was visible, dark gray against her translucent, papery skin. Some of the congregated pixies gasped, others wept.
"Nabi!"
cried Hollywhirl as she became visible. She reached out to touch Nabi's cheek, but her hand went through the image.
"Sister, what's happened to you?"
"I warned you," said Barnabas. "The pool is corrupted. This image does not show the full truth of your sister."
Nabi's image gaped at her sister's shocked expression.
"Is it really that bad?"
Hollywhirl wiped a tear away and nodded. Then she turned to Barnabas.
"But it's really her, isn't it? Nabi's spirit truly resides in this axe?"
"So it appears."
"How can we get her out?"
Barnabas raised his arms in a shrug.
"This is beyond my knowledge of magic."
He turned to the image of Nabi.
"Who did this to you?"
I don't know for sure, but I suspect very strongly that it was the Dark Lord who saps the life out of this wood.
Cooper took a couple of steps back, hoping that he was far enough away to not transmit his thought that she was sapping the life out of his wood.
There is one person who can tell us how to release you from this instrument of destruction,
Hollyworld said to Nabee. Nabee raised her eyebrows, making her face look even more gaunt and grotesque than before.
Who is that?
The same person who put you in there.
You don't mean...
We must enter Morning Glory Hole.
Cooper snorted. Everyone who was visible turned to give him a stern glare.
Sorry,
he said.
The seasonal allergies.
No,
said Nabee.
It's too dangerous. You'll only end up the same as me, or even worse. Cooper and I must go alone.
Wait, what?
Said Cooper.
I don't want to lose you again, sister,
said Hollyworld.
The Fae folk need a leader, and I am unfit for such a position.
Poppycock, I've seen you in action. You're a little rough around the edges, but the other pixies respect you. That reminds me, the half-orc, Cooper, and I entrust one another with our lives. He has been nothing less than a perfect gentleman, and I give my consent to lay with him as he sleeps.
Cooper farted in vindication.
I told you.
Please, Nabee, let us join you. There is safety in numbers. You've already been in the hole. You know the goblins' traps, so we can avoid them.
How will all of you avoid a cave full of webs? Cooper is strong and dense, and I am currently an axe. We have little to fear from webs. Our job is to rid this wood of the Dark Lord and return my spirit to its proper body. Your job is to make sure I have a home to return to.
Hollyworld hung her head in resignation.
Very well, sister. I...
Something that looked like a beanbag flew into the space between the four trees and exploded into a white cloud of what looked like flour. Two more explosions followed, one below the first one and another above it. The pixies, which had chosen to remain invisible, now resembled ghostly white apparitions. They also appeared drunk. The powder had apparently blinded them, causing them to fly into the tree trunks, branches, and each other.
What is this?
Demanded Nabee.
What's happening?
Barnabas pointed to a cluster of bushes about 20 yards behind Cooper.
Goblins!
He spoke some additional words that Cooper didn't understand, and the bushes seized five screaming goblins in their prickly branches.
They followed us!
Cried one of the white, drunk-looking pixies, hovering aimlessly between the four trees.
They must have seen the wolf!
He and the two other pixies were caught in a flying net. It had been launched by a group of goblins on one side of the trees using a mounted contraption that looked like an eight-barreled crossbow. A group on the other side of the trees stood by a similar contraption, which was still loaded. They took aim and fired, netting four or more pixies out of the air. Each group intercepted the other's catch and secured the netting. A dozen more crossbows released simultaneously, most from shooters who were still managing to remain concealed. A few of them, who had obviously rolled poorly on their hide checks, were easy to spot, crouched behind trees, rocks, and bushes. Barnabas dropped like a sack of pincushions.
Snuffles! Pork pie!
Said the pixie, who sounded like the one who jerked off Chaz the previous night. Dingle tits or something.
Hurry! Run!
A boar ran from their loosened straps, but a net shot out at Dingle tits, who had managed to avoid getting covered in flour, making the net look like a sentient blob made out of ropes.
Cooper!
Cried Nabee.
Take me! Take me now!
As if he didn't have enough shit to deal with right now, she was also going to dump on him the added pressure of finding a way to let her down gently.
I cherish our friendship too much. I don't want to ruin what we have.
The holographic image of Nabee glared at him.
Take me out of the water and use me to fight the goblins, you fat stupid fuck.
Oh, right.
Cooper shrugged off a couple of crossbow bolts as he ran to the pool of true sight, appreciating that Nabee was picking up some colloquialisms from him. The water was pitch black with zero visibility. He was going to have to feel for the axe. He reached over the oak roots, which formed a side of the pool, and felt around under the water. It was warm and slimy, slick, with an oily film on top. Fortunately, it wasn't very deep. The bite of another bolt in his ass and the thuds of two more hitting the tree right next to him told Cooper that his time was running out.
Get in the pool,
said Nabee. He jumped over the roots to take cover in the pool. Finally, he found the axe's handle. He pulled it out of the water, causing Nabee's image to disappear.
Hurry, it's up to us now.
We must save them. Wonderful. She was back inside his head. The scene didn't look promising. Barnabas was a goner. Chaz and Zagnuts were both down. All of the pixies, which had been covered in white powder, were captured, and possibly some others as well. A couple of goblins had fallen, but more remained than what Cooper thought he could reasonably handle between only himself and a bee. Then again, reason was never his strong suit. He stood tall and raised Nabi high.
I'm really...
Somewhere between half a dozen and eight dozen bolts tore into Cooper's chest, arms, legs, gut, and ass. The last two things he felt were a splash and a fart, which may or may not have been just a fart. Chapter 36. If Dave could count himself lucky about anything in his current state, it would be that his base movement speed seemed to be doubled in rat form. It was bad enough to suddenly discover he was both a murderer and a monster, then to have the townsfolk try to lynch him for merely existing, not to mention having to trudge aimlessly through a sewer to get away from them. At least he was eventually able to outrun them. But now that he thought about it, the sewer wasn't as bad as he remembered from his previous experiences trudging through it. It was funny how viable a traveling option sewers were in this world. Dave had been in some tight situations back in the real world, but had never once even entertained the idea of crawling down a manhole and fleeing danger through his neighbor's liquid shit. Maybe he should have. At least the sewers back home could be counted on to be relatively free of monsters. Dave was scared, and telling himself that he was the monster people feared did little to help. They didn't fear him. Not like someone fears a prize fighter or a bear. He was no badass. They feared his disease. Lycanthropy was the leprosy or AIDS of this world. They feared becoming what he was. Well, fuck them. He didn't have leprosy or AIDS. What he had wasn't going to kill him, after all. His disease was actually a blessing when he got right down to it. Sure, he might lose control of himself a couple of times a month, but that could be mitigated. All the rest of the time, he had new powers. He could shapeshift. He was a lot tougher to kill. He could finally move at a reasonable speed. This was way better than merely not AIDS, in fact. This was fucking awesome. And as long as he was looking on the bright side of things, the smell down here wasn't so much offensive as it was acquired. Being in rat form to better stay out of sight from any predators or pitchfork-wielding redneck townsfolk, he had his nose right down there at shit level. It wasn't necessarily a scent he'd try to bottle and sell, but it had an earthy quality that wasn't entirely unpleasant, like a strong cheese or one's own fart. Dave slowed his pace, then stopped walking altogether. His pursuers had stopped pursuing him a while ago. As a matter of fact, he wasn't sure if they'd even set foot in the sewer proper. They probably got justifiably freaked out by the pile of chopped-up bodies lying just outside of it. Unfortunately, his dwarven dark vision didn't work in rat form. He must have had low-light vision as a rat, as he'd been able to see where he was going this far with next to no light. But now that he was getting closer to actual total darkness, he couldn't see 5 feet in front of him. That seemed unreasonable. Didn't dire rats live in sewers after all? How did they survive down here without being able to see? How was he going to survive? Blindness aside, what the hell was he going to do in the sewer? He couldn't live down here. There was nothing to eat, and there was someone or something apparently hunting down and slaughtering were-rats. He just needed to wait a few minutes, make sure the mob had dispersed, then think of somewhere safe to go. The horse head was certainly off the table for now. He could go to a temple and beg them to cure him, but he wasn't sure that he wanted to be cured. Perhaps a blacksmith. He could explain his situation and pay a couple of gold pieces to be locked in a strong steel cage while he wasn't in control of himself. Or hell, maybe just another place with a cellar. The Horsehead Inn had a cellar. The Piss Bucket Tavern had a cellar. Dave wasn't the first person in the world to contract lycanthropy. Surely it was a common enough issue that there was standard established protocol, beyond lynch mobs, to accommodate people like Dave who chose to make the best out of their situations and voluntarily have themselves locked up overnight during the full moon. It was probably a bustling industry. It was just a matter of figuring out a way to ask people without freaking them out. Do you know of any temporary lycanthropy housing facilities? I'm asking for a friend. That probably wasn't going to cut it, especially if he was naked. His clothing issue would need to be addressed before he worked on his pitch. Some of the dead bodies outside had clothes on. Most of it was torn to shreds, but it might be a solid starting point. If he was able to scrape something together, which would allow him to walk the streets without calling too much attention to himself while he searched for better options, he could find a tarp or an old blanket or something and pass for an ordinary vagrant. Then again, rooting through a pile of corpses and stripping off their clothes would make for a whole new level of awkwardness if anyone caught him doing it. Maybe there was something down here he could use. He couldn't think of what exactly he might find in a sewer that he'd want to wear outside, but people dumped all manner of garbage down here. Literally anything that covered his junk would suffice. It was worth a peek anyway, just for the offhand chance that it might obviate the corpse-stripping option. Bracing himself for the pain, he focused on morphing back into a dwarf. It got easier to bear each time he changed forms. The exception this time came not from the changing itself, but from the overpowering stench of shit, or rather his reaction to it. Vomit exploded out of Dave's mouth and a little through his nose. Tears welled up in his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. The smell hadn't changed at all. How did he possibly think this was okay just a moment ago? Then it occurred to him. He was a rat. Rats are accustomed to living in shit. He wiped the tears out of his eyes, took a few deep breaths, then threw up again. He'd been in a lot of low places in life, but this might be rock bottom. He sobbed softly and wiped his eyes again, resolved to not turn back into a rat before he made use of his dark vision. 4 dire rats, 2 were-rats in hybrid form, and a naked half-orc with a dong hanging down almost to his knees were staring back at him.
Jesus Christ!
Dave immediately covered his junk with both hands.
Get him!
Said the impressively endowed half-orc. The others charged at Dave. He reverted back into his rat form, not because he fancied his chances of being able to escape, but more so that he wouldn't have to suffer revulsion at the stench of shit on top of whatever they were going to do to him. And if he was being totally honest, also because the half-orc's giant dong was making him feel a little inadequate. Chapter 37. Stacy claimed to recall having seen mountains on the northern horizon before she hurled them both off the crescent shadow. And now that he thought about it, Julian seemed to recall having seen them too. Of course, that could have very well been the powers of suggestion and wishful thinking playing tricks on his memory. But with nothing else to go on, and a seemingly endless expanse in every direction, north was the direction he guided the magical horse they were riding.
"I suppose it's possible I was mistaken," said Stacy, about an hour into the ride, when the horizon continued to offer nothing but more sand. Julian suspected she was right about having been mistaken, but that didn't make much difference at this point.
"We've already committed time and miles to this direction. We might as well stick with it."
In the haste of their departure from the crescent shadow, they hadn't prepared for a trek through the desert. They had no water and no food, except what meager fruit they could conjure up by peeing on the sand, and that wasn't going to last long. They had a couple of days tops, and Julian's limited number of mount spells meant that they'd be doing more walking than riding.
"Maybe we'll be able to see something useful at night," Stacy spoke cheerfully, but it sounded forced to Julian. The fact that she felt the need to boost his morale was kind of demoralizing. "Who knows? The glow of city lights? A fireworks show? A wizard battle? A fire-breathing? Look!" Julian pointed ahead at a speck on the horizon. It wasn't civilization, a shimmering oasis, or a Dairy Queen, any of which he would have been beyond grateful for. It probably wasn't anything that would help their situation in the least, but it was something besides sand, and that was enough to justify a bit of excitement. As they rode closer, the object on the horizon appeared to be some kind of creature. Stacy rested her chin on Julian's shoulder. "Is that a centaur?"
"I don't think so," said Julian. "The lower half doesn't look very horse-like."
The legs were shorter than a horse's, more like a lion, maybe. The torso was definitely humanoid, though.
"It's kind of weird how it isn't moving at all."
It was completely motionless, sitting on its hind legs and facing east with its arms folded across its chest and a stern expression on its human-like face. Another strange feature was that it was charcoal gray from head to whatever passed for toe. That hadn't seemed so strange from a distance because Julian thought it was silhouetted. But now that they were close enough to make out color and texture, both of which suggested it was made out of stone.
"It's a statue,"
said Stacy, as Julian cautiously slowed his horse. Julian was no art expert, but this thing looked to be extremely well-crafted. In fact, the sculptor